WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello. First of all, am I ready?
You're on the air.
First of all, I just wanted to congratulate everybody who was on the panel. It was the most heartwarming thing I'd heard in a long time. And I just wanted to ask one of the officers there, or whoever he is, one question. Would you wait a second till I turn this down, radio down? Can you wait a second?
Sure.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
What kind of, would you ask him what kind of press attended the thing, and secondly, of those who came, does he have any idea what percentage came through with any stories?
Well, you just asked him.
Well, I don't know the extent of the press coverage. I know there was a lot of people there, and they took a lot of interviews. And myself, and I'm sure most of the other men that testified, asked for packets, news packets of the interviews we gave, and I haven't received any.
Do you know whether there were major papers or...
The New York Times was one of them.
And network TV or whatnot?
I saw, I think, two network TVs. I don't remember which ones they were. They came for about 10 minutes in the middle of something, and they left. And they didn't really seem interested. It was like a token visit.
Oh, I didn't happen to see any coverage of it. I wasn't here in New York at that time. Maybe that's why. But the networks didn't use any of it?
I understand there was a two-minute spot just showing them asking some veterans some questions inside a different room, not in the testimony room.
I don't want to keep you, but I'd like to ask one other thing. What happens to a person who is very, in terms of the count, I hate the word body count, I can't stand it, I'm afraid. If somebody who's badly injured on, say, Wednesday, but he doesn't die until Thursday or Friday, does he figure into the statistics as a casualty, as a death casualty or not?
No, he doesn't.
So that all the badly injured who afterward die would put that count way, way up. Is that it?
Yes, yeah, so most of those that die like that are unreal. They're non-combat deaths. That's how they list them.
Oh, for the love of God.
Also, it's rather interesting that we were embargoed at the same time the Laos invasion was embargoed.
At the same time the moonshot was not.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye.
WBAI, you're on the air. Hello? If you'll turn down your radio, you'll realize that you're on the air.
Hi. Hi, the thing that really struck me in the testimony is how you referred to how it was referred to the Vietnamese as groups like South Vietnamese, North Vietnamese. Now, I was wondering, was this in your basic training that you were told they were all groups? Was this handed down when you got to South Vietnam, one soldier to another, and your sergeants? How did they talk to the men?
I went through basic before the war started going, but Orientals were never on the record referred to as gooks, but always through training, like when you bayoneted a dummy or anything like that, it was always kill the gook. Continually, every conversation you had with officers or staff NCOs, or non-commissioned officers, in other words, sergeants and above, they always referred to Orientals as gooks. Though it was never official, it was like that little four-letter word that nobody of us are supposed to ever mention but always do. It was always off the record, but it was always continually there until you started referring to it in the same manner. And then by doing so, by making that association, perhaps unconsciously, it's just one more dehumanizing effect upon you so that it's easier for you to do the dirty work.
Oh, I see. Just one more question. I realize you didn't go into this because it's really, you know, an opinion of people. But what is the percentage of people who support the Viet Cong or the South Vietnamese? Is there any, like, the civilian population? What do the soldiers feel in general? Do they have any attitude towards how the civilians feel towards South Vietnamese government, North Vietnamese government?
Well, the American soldier, on the average, has contempt for Vietnamese. There are a few that do not, and they're generally isolated and called communist or...
No, I was wondering how they feel that the South and may civilians think of
how they feel
of the Saigon government or the Viet Cong? Like, which ones are the percentage on our side or on the Viet Cong side?
Well, it's rather apparent that since it's taken 10 years, that the average person living in South Vietnam, and I'm calling them South Vietnamese because Vietnamese don't refer to themselves in that way, the people who live in the south of the 17th parallel generally prefer the NLF-PRG platform. Else they wouldn't be fighting us for so long, and that's the reason why, one of the reasons why we're burning their villages down and relocating them into the cities. It's called forced urbanization. You burn out their villages, force them into helicopters, and throw them down in the Saigon, Cholon, or Da Nang slums, and you've got them rounded up. In the meantime, we export police experts to teach Saigon government cops how to keep these people in check, how to control them. Some of our finest experts from Harlem, from Watts, you know, the men that have had experience with repressing our own people, they'll teach the Vietnamese how to do it also.
I see. Thank you very much.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah. I was wondering, what suggestion would the people there have to reaching, boys before they get drafted, say kids in high school, in a small town where there is quite a blackout on the atrocities committed in Vietnam? Like, I taught as a kind of as a substitute teacher in Pennsylvania, and I was kind of kicked out of school because I talked about the war, and there just doesn't seem to be any way that the kids are getting information.
Yeah, the high schools are extremely important.
Yeah, right.
After we had the People's Army Jamboree in Portland against the American Legion, we tried getting seminars going with the vets group into the different high schools. We tried to set on ongoing seminars concerning the war, the United States military, and American foreign policy in general, seeing as American foreign policy generally turns out to be a guy running around with a rifle. Mm-hmm. We felt we were somewhat experts at it. And we tried to get these ongoing seminars. Well, every damned one of those schools refused us because, I mean, this is the next fodder. They don't, I mean, they're having enough problems with people splitting from the draft as it is without sanctioning seminars to tell these kids that they're going to go off and die.
Well,
and
the
they better
is
not.
About the schools is that they talk about democracy, but most schools are run like fascist empires.
Of course.
They don't want any differences of opinion.
They're getting government money, and they're all worried about the educational cuts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So therefore, if they're getting government money, then they're not going to go against government policy, and they've got to have a generation that's going to kill. If you take a look at the American education system is only training us to be functionaries anyway,
mm-hmm.
and the military to be one nice step towards pummeling us even into a more of a functionary-minded type of person, you know, willing to take orders and willing to live a gray, apathetic life, willing to take these absurd material values as spiritual values, make that substitution. The military is a very necessary step towards that manipulation.
Another thing, I understand Jane Fonda is going to do kind of a counter-USO show, and, well, I don't think it'll be allowed on the bases, but probably at local coffee houses near the bases. Is there any way any of your people could go along with that, or am I too naive to think that would even be allowed, you know, in the local coffee houses? You know, rap with the soldiers.
Well, you know, the coffee houses around the bases, and they're always coming down with a great sense of repression against them anyway. Now, I don't know how successful Fonda's going to be. It's an interesting point she's brought out, and I know the Army's going to turn it down just flat.
Yeah.
But the legality of that could be rather interesting and tested, and therefore she might still put on her show in a coffee house near a base. And I believe there'll be quite a few veterans supporting it in that area, and we'll be able to do rap sessions. But these are ongoing things anyway. What Fonda's planning is an event, which sometimes in the American mind, events like our and demonstrations are like big football games, and they overshadow the day-to-day work. And this is what's going on in the coffee houses. She's going to make something of a spectacular thing out of it. But vets around coffee houses, around all these bases, have been working continually, talking with soldiers, and just talking, rapping, and helping them.
Okay, I'd like to go on to another call now.
Thank you very much.
Right. This is WBAI in New York City. And with me in the studio, my name is Paul Fisher, and with me in the studio are former Marine Sergeant Mike McCusker and Scott Camille of the 1st Marine Division, both of whom were participants in the Winter Soldier investigation. If you'd like to talk to them, the phone number is Oxford 78506, and now we'll go on to another call. WBAI, WBAI, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Since the big hang-up of going any farther with the Winter Soldier tapes right now is a problem of getting the thing off tape and onto paper, what about asking if there's anyone listening who is skilled at transcribing and then giving the officer's phone number?
Well, as far as I understand, and you can check me out on this, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War are planning to come out with this in a paperback version, aren't they?
Yeah, no, I just called them. I'm a member of the organization. And our problem is that of the, 24 hours we've got on tape, we only have about 3 hours on paper. There's just a physical problem of getting the stuff off the tape and onto the paper.
Well, okay. If anybody out there is interested, they can give us a call. You've said it. Okay?
And our phone number is 255-8140.
Okay, done.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. VAI, you're on the air.
Yeah. Oh, I don't hear myself on the radio.
Yeah, we'll turn it down. We're on tape delay.
Oh, okay. Right. I wanted to ask, I noticed when the guys were testifying that many times they didn't mention the names of their officers who were responsible for some of these orders.
Right. There was a reason for that, and I think Scott Camille can answer that.
The main reason is because we have no immunity. No one testified to things that they actually did. We testified to what we saw that was done. To protect ourselves, and we don't feel that our officers that participated or let these things happen are really responsible. It goes much higher up, and we don't want to see them punished.
Yeah, I see. Okay, that's all I want to ask. Thank you.
Though, Scott,
you can
tell me if I'm wrong, but I do believe that some of the people there testified to committing atrocities, not just witnessing them.
Yeah, this is McCusker. There was a split somewhat. Some testified to actually what they did, and others to actually what they saw. It was up to each man as to what he was going to say. Some men wanted to protect themselves, I would say, from prosecution, and some still don't even want to admit publicly that they did these things because they're having enough time admitting it to themselves or fighting it out in their own heads.
Right.
Now, we're already going to be set up as a bunch of little Callies. You've got to take that into consideration. The Pentagon and the government forces are going to try to make us look like perverts. They're going to try and make us look like animals, make us look like Callies, so that once again throw it away from government policy and put it back on individuals. So we're going to be set up that way as it is. And if we start naming officers, then we're setting up other people to be this way. And the government can continually try to separate us and isolate us into individuals and try to move away from the fact that this is actual policy. Now, what we did, and the advantage of those 3 days, is we knit together at least 6 years of American policy. Guys that were running around in Laos in 61 and 62 testified. Guys that invaded Laos in Dewey Canyon just a year ago. You see, we knit all these years together, and the same things were being done.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is, if nothing else, policy. Because a guy that went in 61, or let's say a guy that went in 66, is not going to know too much about what a guy did in 61, because the military ain't going to tell him. And it's the same damn thing with a guy in the NAM in 69 and 70. He's not going to be too aware of what the guy in 66 did,
yeah.
You know, when he's there. So, but when you knit it all together and realize these guys are doing the same thing and we're getting the same go-ahead, the unofficial nod of the head to do this, forced into this position of doing these things so that they react this way, and they are, the whole policy sets up like search and destroy. You sweep through and you burn a village. And, I mean, they've been burning villages in that country since, 1956, then the Advisor 61, then our buildup. You know the whole history of it.
Yeah.
And so by tying it all together, that in itself is, I think, a very, very good finger at government policy.
In other words, it's not just the officers.
No, it's so much more. The whole complex pattern of molding a person into participating in these things, into doing these things, and able to justify it to himself. Combat itself is a very, very primitive thing. And when you're in combat, you respond out of fear, and you respond out of wanting to survive. And the question is, who put you in that position? Why did they put you in that position? How do they continually set you up in that position?
Yeah. Okay, we're going to go on to another call now. Thank you. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to ask a couple of questions. Actually, it's one question in three parts. What has been the reaction of most vets when they were asked to testify? I know that I was working in attempting to set up the commissions of inquiry a year ago with Ralph Schoenemann and the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation. And at that time, of course, there were very few vets who would wanted to testify, and we felt that after the My Lai massacre, there was a much larger possibility that that is after the My Lai massacre disclosure. We felt that there was a much larger possibility that vets would want to come forward and tell what they saw in Vietnam. What kind of reaction have you been getting these days? And is there the possibility, on the basis of that reaction, for large numbers, even larger than the really magnificent number of 100 or more that testified in Detroit, is there the possibility that, that a mass veteran anti-war movement can actually be built? Is that your feeling as a possibility right now? And thirdly, what can people do to help? Incidentally, in connection with that, one of the things that that I was doing was attempting to get this kind of testimony from veterans who are going to NYU, as well as trying to present to the people at NYU, this was a year ago, a good cross-section of the kind of war crimes that that we knew about at that time. And this was in conjunction with the Vietnam vets.
Okay, this is McCusker. Now, I testified in both the citizens' inquiry in D.C. in December, and then I testified in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we had 40 veterans testify in D.C., roughly the size of a platoon. Also, we had bios of 80 other people. We just couldn't afford to get there, but were willing to testify. Okay, so that's that body count. Now, about 300 veterans showed up to Detroit, but we only had enough
300.
Room. And, yeah, 300. And we only had enough room and time for 100 to testify.
Oh, that's incredible.
And since the Playboy ad and since Detroit, we've been getting, well, it's leveled out now to the average of response from 40 to 50 veterans a day.
Oh, my. So that means that that you really have the basis to start organizing a big section of anti-war sentiment that had not really been able to be organized before. Because I know that there have been efforts to organize vets in the past against the war, but do you think that it's possible that this can reach mass proportions on a continuing basis at this point?
This is Scott Camille.
Yeah.
I think very much so. That's one of the reasons we're here in New York now, to get together nationally so we can organize locally and get to the veterans locally, explain to them what we've done, try to get their fears away from them, about what Big Brother's going to do to them.
Yeah. I see. Well, I know, for example, at NYU, where we've been doing work with the New University Conference and the Committee to End the War in Vietnam, we knew that there were 3,000 vets at NYU on a GI Bill of some kind, or at least this is the figure we were given. Scott Moore had that, and so that we knew there was a tremendous potential from the point of view of the number of vets on campuses. Are you going to be concentrating on campuses?
It's easy to concentrate on campuses because there's a lot of veterans there, and it's just that most of the campuses make it very hard for us to get the names. I go to the University of Florida. We have 1,400 vets, and we've just gotten permission to get a list of these names, but we have to copy them down by pencil in hand. They won't give us the list.
Yeah, that was the same problem we had. Also, there was a friend of mine who was operating out of Manhattan College who had an enormous, enormously strategic position from the point of view of helping vets to find out about various services that vets could receive, at the same time as you know, not steering them to the American Legion and the Veterans of Foreign Wars. Is this the kind of thing you're going to be doing?
That's just part of what we're going to be doing.
Yeah.
We're going to try to set up, you know, as much of a service as possible, and not only on the campuses either, because, you know, really, as many vets are on the campus,
sure,
there's thousands more working in the, working, well,
yep,
collecting their unemployment checks these days.
Or not.
Yeah. And also, I lost my train of thought. Pick it up, Scott.
Okay.
Well, what can people do to help? That's really the...
Well, this is going to really sound silly, but putting pressure on your congressman, writing your congressman, asking them why they haven't looked into Winter Soldier investigations, ask them why they won't give us immunity, why won't they bring us to Congress to testify to what we saw, to find out from the veterans themselves what's really going on. Why won't they do it? If they're really interested in what's going on, why won't they do it? It's not that hard.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, with regard to that, the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation and the tribunal that was held has been, that tribunal, the information on it has been out in print now since early in 1969. It's a book called Against the Crime of Silence, which methodically goes over the whole question of war crimes inside and out, and with cross-examination and with documentation and with showing the policy and showing what was being done, what kind of ordinance, for example, with regard to fragmentation bombs and so forth. They even went to Vietnam and did autopsies and did medical examinations of the victims. It was done in an extremely systematic fashion, and this has all been in print. And we, at that time, sent that book to specific congressmen and senators and so forth. It is not a question of them not knowing about what's going on, so that therefore I imagine you don't have any illusions that it's just been a matter of their not knowing. That is the congressman.
Well, it's like I've got several books written in 1943, 1944, and 1945, laying out the whole Japanese system of government,
right,
and the emperor as a figurehead and not a maker or determiner of policy. However, we dropped the two atomic bombs because we said the emperor was a maker of policy,
right,
and you know damned well that most of the government knew exactly where the emperor stood, and yet that bomb was dropped on the auspices that the emperor was a maker of policy.
Yeah, well, you see, that's the whole point here, that with regard to the pressuring of congressmen and pressuring of the government, I think that has a certain amount of value to the American people in the sense that it tells them that, you know, that at least we're going through that step. We're going through the governmental apparatus. But if we do it without illusions, then we don't have to waste time with the kind of jobs that we really have to do, and that is of organizing ourselves, and especially the fact that the veterans are so many of them, black, Puerto Rican, working class, that this is a tremendous entree into the working classes, which is one of the social forces which can actually bring an end to this war.
Okay.
I think a lot of people have illusions with regard to the working class lack of anti-war sentiment because of all the propaganda about the hard hats and all kinds of propaganda which tend to drive a wedge between the anti-war movement and the working class.
Okay,
but,
we've really got to move on.
Yeah, right, I'm sorry.
Paul.
Okay, thank you very much.
Could I address just one to that?
Hold on a second.
Yeah.
Because the dichotomy between the working class and the anti-war movement, let's face it, my father has to pay the taxes and had to send his son to Vietnam. And that's the whole trip. The whole thing of the war is coming out of the working
right.
class. They're paying for it, not the Nixons or the Rockefellers. And so they've got to continually be kept to keep doing it. And in the meantime, our minority groups are the ones who are being used out in the front, as all armies do, the killing of two birds with one stone. You kill off your own minority groups, killing off the so-called enemy. And
yeah,
it works in that circle.
Well, I really appreciate the work that you've done. And thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Okay.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello. I was really, I got a real deep feeling of what was going on as the testimony. And you were speaking before about policy. You were talking about the idea of who were the soldiers in the position Vietnam? Why was this policy put into effect? Who in effect was, and why were they trying to dehumanize American soldiers to the point where they could only view an Oriental in terms of something other than human? I'd like your comment, if nothing else, to suggest as to what are the possible motivations for this, strictly in military terms, in terms of the fact, and I'd like to offer some suggestion, strictly in terms of the fact that our military, who have portrayed themselves to be the heads of what is an invincible military machine, have been very much less than successful in dealing with what militarily is certainly a fourth-rate power in the world, and that these are really panic operations on their part in an attempt to justify what have been up to this point practically 10 years of failure.
Yeah, well, this invincible military machine portrays itself, of course, as the defender of God, without alluding to the fact that the only reason there's a military machine at all is to kill. And this seems to be the history of armies. They build up a defense posture, then they flex their muscles and want to go out and use them. And this is the whole trip, or partially the trip, I should say, with what the military is doing, because the military has always got to keep a war going, keep some experienced men continually in the ranks. It keeps rank going, you know, more and more promotions and that sort of thing, and more glory, more medals, more battle pennants. And then there's the Western as against the Eastern world, and the war against Japan was not because Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, but an Asian nation actually had the guts to stand up and stand off the Western world. And the Southeast Asia policy is to keep American economic, keep American sphere of influence over most of the world. And these are oversimplifications, which I'm stressing. But like we were in Detroit, and South Vietnam announced that it's going to open bids for the Gulf of Siam oil deposits. And in 1968, Petroleum Magazine laid out a map of who was going to get what in the Gulf of Siam, as far as offshore drilling within that Gulf is. And yet that's still only one part of it. And I've had an old woman once told me the reason that we've got to destroy Asians because the Bible says the invaders from the east are going to swallow us all up. You know?
Yeah, well, I'm afraid that you hear people who are willing to pass off all of these, some of the horrible things that are occurring in Southeast Asia in justifications of the superiority of the white American way of life, and in order to be able to justify many of the things, certainly they're not thought out. Well, thanks an awful lot.
Okay, thank you for calling. WBAI, you're on the air.
Just a moment, let me turn down my radio.
She went to turn down the radio. Yes, go ahead.
A few things. First, I wanted to ask if the hearings were filmed.
Yes, they were.
They were. And what do you plan to do with the film?
Well, it wasn't actually filmed by the people involved, was it?
We had the people who filmed it come and film it, and they filmed everything. And they're in the process right now of making a sort of documentary-type movie out of it. I think there was about 30 hours of film, and again, it's a financial thing with what we can do with that. Getting it developed, getting it cut, getting it put together. You can't present something, a movie, you know, like a four-hour movie of just testimony. There's a lot of other things involved, and there's a lot of financial problems.
Yes, I know. I happen to know a few filmmakers. Where could I call you to perhaps put you in touch with someone who might help with the money or the technical part?
All right. I don't have the phone number offhand, but it's in the just call information and ask for the number of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, 156 Fifth Avenue.
Well, we've got the phone number here, actually, if you're really interested.
Oh, you do?
It's 255-8140.
255-8140.
Right.
Right. Now, I'd like to ask, if There's a union. Isn't there this American Servicemen's Union that started a few years back? Has anything much been happening with that? Have people been joining it?
Yes, it's continuing to organize. As a matter of fact, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's only one facet of the rebellion that's going on in the military. But the ASU, you could perhaps say it was finally the first real organized movement within the military. And it's probably the largest, but there are so many other movements also involved. And the military continually, two men on a base will start organizing. So they'll bust both men and send each to another base. Like one will go to Adak, Alaska, and the other one will be sent down to the tip of South America somewhere. Well, that's cool, because then they'll start organizing in those places.
Wonderful.
And you know, it's just they keep sending them back and back to different bases, and the fire is spreading. There's thousands upon thousands of men